if they win the suit, they haven't advanced a single idea on how to solve the healthcare issue that Alaskans confront.
Sharp criticism for the state's challenge to the federal healthcare law. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 22nd of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a museum exhibit highlights the unique battlefield of Kiska during World War II.
This is massive development for 1 year. I mean, you have 5,000 Japanese soldiers tearing the place up. So it's a massive military development, and then they all leave.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by North Rim Bank, reminding you that you have a second chance to help other Alaskans. If you filed for your PFD online, you can safely donate a portion of your dividend to your favorite Alaska cause. Log into the PFD website and pick, click, give.
Candidates that want to take Sean Parnell's seat in the governor's office are reacting to this week's announcement that he's making a constitutional challenge to the federal health care legislation that passed Congress earlier this year. Many of them see the litigation as a distraction from what the governor needs to be talking about. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The announcement came as no surprise that Governor Parnell had decided to join 19 other states in a lawsuit claiming that the federal government had overstepped its constitutional authority by requiring individuals to purchase health care insurance or face a tax penalty. He had said before it became law that he was opposed to the idea. However, Ralph Samuels and Bill Walker, running in the August Republican election against the governor, say the lawsuit was discussed at the state GOP convention the week before. Samuels says there was no opposition among party members to what the governor did, but they wanted to hear about the future, gas lines and oil production and the economy. He points to the timing of the announcement, only 2 days after the legislature passed two of the biggest budgets in the state's history.
Immediately, you've saved this lawsuit against the feds. You've saved this for when you want to deflect. And lo and behold, you know, there's the spin on the capital budget and the operating budget, and now the story will be healthcare. And sure, and the timing, you know, I chuckled. There's not much more I can do about it. But, you know, we've been calling for this lawsuit since day one, since the first couple of states filed.
Samuel said it's easier to direct the conversation to subjects where there is agreement. He says the announcement shows that Parnell doesn't want to talk about gas lines or high state spending. He says pushing back against the federal government reflects the will of the majority of Alaskans, including the other candidates. Samuel says he wants to talk about the issues where there are stark differences, like what the state's economy will look like 10 years from now. And Bill Walker sees health care as an important subject, but he says the state's economy is heading for a financial cliff. And his public opinion polls show the economy is the top issue for 95% of Alaskans. And he doesn't understand not talking about an oil pipeline that operates at a third of its capacity right now.
I think it's let's talk about something else, because he certainly doesn't seem to engage much in that discussion. Given the opportunity at the various speaking opportunities he's had, there's been very little discussion on that. So I think he's uncomfortable with the position he finds himself in and seems to be comfortable staying in that position.
Democrats in the race may see the lawsuit as a distraction to Republican candidates and voters, but they want to focus on the health care litigation itself. Hollis French questions court action when Parnell never criticized the Republicans' attempt to get Congress to act on mandatory insurance back in the 90s, and Ethan Berkowitz questions the results of a lawsuit without working on an alternative.
If they win the suit, they haven't advanced a single idea on how to solve the health care issue that Alaskans confront. And if they lose the suit, they still haven't advanced an idea. So to me, this is a big distraction. It doesn't advance the cause of health care. It doesn't help the Alaskan people very much, aside from providing some pretty good political theater.
And Democrat Bob Poe sees the suit as an appeal to the more conservative Republicans, those who still see the appeal of the legacy he inherited when he took office, the current gas line plans, and fighting the federal government.
What the governor is doing is trying to shore up his conservative credentials while at the same time probably endangering things that I think are much more important for the state of Alaska, like long-term oil and gas development to keep revenues coming to the state.
Governor Parnell did not reply to her request for comment. However, immediately following the adjournment of this year's legislative session Monday morning, he pointed to success on a wide variety of issues that he worked on during his first year.
We made great progress on a lot of fronts, from economic, our economic agenda when it comes to the cruise ship tax reduction, oil tax credits, when it comes to deferred maintenance plan, when it comes to new infrastructure, when it comes to merit scholarships, you know, providing that opportunity for our young people. I'm just very thankful for where we are today.
And Parnell made some of the same observations as his opponents. For example, he has to cut state spending approved by the legislature. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Alaska Communications Systems wants to hang up on clunky payphone service in the wireless age. The telecommunications company wants to end public landline phone service by the end of this month. But the Regulatory Commission of Alaska has put the idea on hold. RCA is disputing the ACS plan and has asked the public to weigh in on the matter. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
That sound may soon go the way of the dodo. Alaska Communications Systems, or ACS, is planning to end payphone service in all the areas it serves across the state. According to ACS spokesperson Heather Cavanaugh, the Anchorage-based telecommunications company will disconnect payphones in urban areas it serves, as well as in more than 30 rural communities from Thorne Bay to Nulato.
We began decommissioning our payphones earlier this year across the state in multiple locations. We had sent a courtesy notice to the RCA in February and just heard back from them last week. Part of why we didn't see this as being an issue with the RCA is because Congress deregulated payphones in 1996.
ACS contends the public phones are not used enough anymore to make them pay, although it costs the company to maintain them.
Really, the reason we're getting out of the business is because we're just not seeing the demand there anymore. In the past year alone, from 2008 to 2009, we saw a 69% decline in the use of payphones, and really, we're seeing such an increase in the use of cell phones that that's probably the reason why most payphones are being left unused or underutilized.
Cavanaugh says cell phones are in such common use now that, according to national trends, the number of payphones in the United States has dropped from 2.1 million in 1998 to 870,000 in 2007. But the Regulatory Commission of Alaska is not getting a dial tone, so to speak, when it comes to ACS's plan.
We don't know exactly what locations or how many payphones they have out there. And that's one of the things that we've asked ACS to reply to us.
Grace Salazar, who doubles as the commission's consumer protection head and the agency's spokesperson, says ACS needs to get official approval to end payphone service.
We have a specific statute that requires public utilities to request approval that they are discontinuing or abandoning their certificated service.
RCA certificates are required for any public utility which serves 10 customers or more, Salazar says, and certificate holders by law must seek commission approval for ending such service, and the RCA must provide opportunity for public input before making a decision one way or the other.
It appears that the commission has received about 19 comments, mostly opposing to discontinuing service, especially in rural areas. We actually received a comment from Sitka that many tourists rely on the public payphones and have complained that there aren't public payphones available in the Sitka area.
ACS's Cavanaugh says the phone company is providing alternate communication services to communities that request it.
We've come up with a couple of alternatives whereby we will install a phone for the business or the community, and they'll then be responsible for maintaining it. It costs about $40 a month for kind of a basic business line so that you can make local calls and 800 numbers, and we're happy to help out in those situations.
The Regulatory Commission has issued a formal challenge to the phone company plan and has ordered ACS to respond by April 23rd. Kavanaugh says the phone company has filed for an extension of time for the response.
We believe that a full and thorough response to the issue raised will assist the commission in its analysis of this matter, and that we want to give the proper time and research into the federal and state regulations, statutes, and orders.
The Regulatory Commission of Alaska is asking the public to weigh in by May 16th. Information on the issue can be found on RCA's website. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, at the Native Youth Olympics, it's not just about the competition.
It ties all of the kids throughout the state, Native or non-Native, and encourages them to try their hardest and do their best.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Children's Trust is dedicated to preventing child abuse and neglect in Alaska. Experts tell us that when you listen, talk, and play with your child, the brain develops more fully. So listen, talk, and play. Three simple steps that add up to a brighter future for your child. The Alaska Children's Trust is committed to Alaska's children. For questions about parenting, call the Alaska Parent Line at 1-800-643-KIDS. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust.
The state is weighing in on a deal that could revive the defunct Tulsa-Quatchief mine near Juneau. The company that owned the British Columbia mine went bankrupt last spring. Now the former CEO is part of a group incorporating in Canada as Chieftain Metals. The group hopes to buy the mineral claims and take over the project's Canadian permits. The potential for restarting the mine is renewing environmental concerns in Alaska about the project. From member station KTOO, Rosemary Alexander has more.
Redfern Resources filed bankruptcy in March 2009, before it opened the old Tulsa-Quatchief mine. Since then, the company has been in receivership. Redfern president Terrence Chandler is one of three people incorporating as Chieftain Metals. While Chandler says he could not confirm or deny the formation of a new company, he also acknowledged it's a transaction in progress. He says he's not sure how long the process will take, which involves the sale of mineral claims as well as the transfer of Canadian environmental permits. Earlier this month, the British Columbia Environmental Assessment Office asked the state of Alaska and other interested groups to comment on the possible transfer to an unspecified company. But a Canadian corporation profile report shows Chandler to be an officer of Chieftain Metals, which incorporated in November. Whoever owns the mine, Alaskans for years have been asking,
how are they going to access the river?
The old mine is on the Tulsaquir River, a tributary of the salmon-rich Taku River, about 25 miles south of Juneau. Redfern, in 2007, abandoned a plan to build a road from the mine to Atlin, B.C., proposing instead to operate an air cushion barge up the Taku, using Juneau as a shipping hub. The hover barge would be towed by an amphibious vehicle known as an amphitrack. The vessels require permits from the U.S. Department of Interior, as well as Alaska Departments of Natural Resources and Fish and Game. When Redfern filed bankruptcy, the state permitting process was underway and no decision had been made. If a new company plans a similar operation, the process would start anew, according to Tom Crawford, the state's large mine coordinator.
Hover barge involved traversing land and ice and transitioning from water to land. There was a lot of open water on the Taku River this past winter, and I think that would be additional grounds for looking critically at the air cushion barge proposal, which, you know, for wintertime operations called for it to operate on top of the frozen river.
It may be some time before Chieftain Metals acquires the Tulsaqua and its permits, if it does. Comments are due Monday to B.C. environmental officials. Crawford says the state of Alaska is responding and mine access is a major concern. Commercial fishermen, native and environmental groups also worry about barging up the Taku River. Paul Otero commercial fishes and works with Rivers Without Borders. She says Redfern's track record has been poor, and knowing Chandler is part of a new company hoping to reopen the mine gives her pause. Rivers Without Borders plans to send comments to BC Environmental.
The issue is about the transportation corridor and the use of the river because of the incredible value of the Taku and what will happen if something happens with the water quality and destruction of habitat. I think we would like to see any transfer suspended or waited until we have more information about what their access plan is.
Another major concern is acid drainage from the abandoned copper and zinc mine. For years, the state and other groups have been talking to Redfern and Canadian officials about cleanup, with no resolution. The topic will likely again be part of the state's comments delivered to Canada next week. Meanwhile, $35,000 is in the legislature's capital budget for a study of the effects on the acid mine drainage on Taku River habitat. United Fishermen of Alaska and United Southeast Alaska Gillnetters believe the acidic flow is destroying prime rearing habitat and could have effects on future salmon fisheries. Chris Knight is executive director of the Gillnetters Group.
You know, these fish are going out to sea and they're gone for 5 years. Whatever comes back to the river is probably as pristine can be. Probably the real concern would be eggs or something that's laying down in the acid area. There might be a dead zone or something like that. But that's our only real concern, is about future generations being able to use that area for salmon habitat.
It's not clear if the Department of Fish and Game or Water Quality Division of Environmental Conservation would conduct the study. Knight says the information would be used to push the Canadian government to clean up the old mine. The Taku River is the largest salmon producer in Southeast Alaska. McDowell Group research firm estimates its economic impact to the region at more than $25 million a year. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
The Bethel City Council took a position against the proposed Donlin Creek gold mine at their last meeting. The vote was the first on Donlin since the new council was seated last October. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
The city is in need of some port improvements. Silt has filled in several sections of prime barge docking real estate. Bethel's port director, Pete Williams.
Right now, this summer, I have no place else to park boats. The wall is full. And we don't have a place to anchor because that's filled in.
Williams and some on council thought Donlin might be a good place to look for some money. The proposed mine sits about 200 miles upriver. Mining companies Barrick Gold and NovaGold are hoping to extract what many consider to be the largest undeveloped gold resource in North America. When and if that happens, they'll be in need of a port facility somewhere in the lower Kuskokwim area. At their last council meeting, Councilmember Alan Hippler said whether you're for or against the mine, talking to developers would be a wise move for the city.
This resolution is not an endorsement of the mine. The city council, by passing this, will not be saying that the mine is great or any specific company is something that we want to encourage. We're merely determining whether, in the event that the mine is permitted, the city of Bethel will benefit and enjoy from the increased economic activity in this area, or whether it will bypass Bethel.
But Vice Mayor Eric Middlebrook thought otherwise and took a hard stance against any involvement with Donlin.
Going to Donlin Creek and Barrick Gold and saying, hey, we want to do business with you. We're inviting them to come to the city and do business with it. And I do not want to send that message to Barrick Gold. I really don't want to have anything to do with the mine upriver.
The swing vote came from first-term council member Heather Pike, who said she simply doesn't trust mining giant Barrick Gold.
Actions speak louder than words, and based on the past, I'm not too happy doing business with them in the future. So they've got a lot of convincing me and a great deal of people that I represent in this community that they have the best of intentions of doing business in our Delta and not destroying anything in the meantime.
The 3-4 vote against the proposal will restrict the city manager from pursuing port discussions with developers, but the council did invite Donlin representatives to present at a future council meeting. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Aleutian World War II campaigns on Kiska and Adak are featured in a new exhibit at the Anchorage Museum in honor of National Archaeology Month. It includes never-before-seen personal photos from both Japanese and American soldiers who served on Kiska during the war and artifacts from Adak. KUCB's Ann Hillman has the story.
World War II gun specialist and historian Dirk Spenneman says the battlefield on Kiska is in and of itself a unique cultural artifact.
Everywhere else in the world, you have battlefields which have fought on land where people have lived for centuries before, where you have lots of pre-existing structures, etc., which get demolished in the war, and then people went back there and lived on top of it. So somewhere in this chaos of human habitation is battlefield. Kiska is different because the Aleuts got removed from by the Russians in 1820s, and since then, if you ignore the Navy weather station from 1936, there's nothing on Kiska until the Japanese landed.
And what they left behind included massive guns that were remarkably well preserved by the Aleutian climate. The fog blocked the damaging sun rays, the cold killed microbes, and the isolation kept people at bay. Some of the guns date from the late 1800s and were given to the Japanese by the British.
Even the key museums in Japan have guns which are much more crappy in condition than what Kiska's got to offer. So that is a very great asset.
The Japanese invaded Kiska in 1942 and occupied the island for about a year. In February of 1943, the U.S. built a base on nearby Amchitka. Then, in May of that year, U.S. forces retook Attu Island from the Japanese. That left Kiska in a vulnerable position.
But the moment Attu had fallen, the Japanese position on Kiska was totally untenable. Just put yourself in the position of the Japanese. If the Americans had a base on Attu and an airfield, then an aircraft could take off from Amchitka, drop the bombs on Kiska, fly onto Attu, refuel, rearm, turn around, and drop bombs again on the way back home.
The Japanese knew this and evacuated their 5,000 troops within 1 hour without the American troops ever knowing. When the U.S. invaded Kiska in August of 1943, it was already deserted. Now, the area is a national historic site marked with physical evidence of exactly how different battles and bombings on the island were fought and won.
The fabric, the history fabric of that battle is all there. We can actually analyze it. We can look at some of the Japanese gun positions, and we can look at the bomb craters. And we can tell from it that the American bombing effort was rather more missed than hit.
The new exhibit tries to bring visitors to the historic site through Spenneman's modern photographs and through narratives of people who were stationed there during the war. It also includes artifacts from Adak from the museum's collection. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
The exhibit, titled Kiska and Adak, War in the Aleutians, opens tonight at the Anchorage Museum with a lecture by Professor Spenneman at 7. The Native Youth Olympics got started this morning in downtown Anchorage with the Kneel Jump. Hundreds of students from across the state are participating in 10 events. Many competitors say the annual event is something they look forward to all year long. APRN's Annie Feit has the story as part of our series on Alaska Native education.
The Kneel Jump is not a loud event. It's a power sport that requires deep concentration followed by an explosive burst of energy. The competitors jump as far as they can across the gym floor from a kneeling position.
Good job. 32 and 3/4.
Former NYO athlete David Thomas is calculating the distance each athlete jumps with a tape measure. He has an appreciation for what it takes to be good at the sport.
You use quite a bit of your core muscles and as well as your legs and your upper body, and you have to coordinate all those different muscles to jump as far forward as you can go, and then at the end keep your balance.
Sticking the landing doesn't look easy, but Ariel Gustafson from Unalaska says it's not too bad once you get the hang of it.
I would say that it's hard, but I've been doing it for a lot of years, so it's not that hard anymore. You just have to remember certain things, like your feet have to be flat on the ground, and you have to use your arms too. It's not just a legs thing.
Aurora Warrior says she's been practicing all year for the Neil jump. The Wasilla athlete has a bright red sore on her chin as a reminder of a recent jump that didn't go well.
It's difficult. It takes a lot of coordination to leave the ground with actually both knees and land with both feet. I've tripped a couple times, landed on my face and skidded my chin, so it's pretty difficult.
But this morning, Aurora is confidently sticking her landings. She says the energy at NYO is exhilarating, and as she watches the other competitors jump, she cheers loudly, whether they're from her team or not.
That's what these games are about, is like getting to know other people and getting to know where they come from and their background, and just making friends, because really these connections that you make right now are going to last a lifetime. And this is the funnest thing I've done all year.
That sentiment is echoed again and again from both the athletes and the coaches. Nicole Johnston is one of the head NYO officials. She attended the first games as a seventh grader in 1982.
Well, the games really are my passion. I spend most of my free time having something to do with all types of traditional Native games, whether it's Native Youth Olympics, World Eskimo Indian Olympics, or Arctic Winter Games. And it's just, it's a real honor, actually, to be an official.
In 1982, only a few hundred kids competed. Now more than 500 participate from around the state. Johnston says the games keep the kids in shape, but also helps prepare them mentally for everyday life.
It ties all of the kids throughout the state, Native or non-Native, and encourages them to try their hardest and do their best. And also teaches them that these are the games that our elders played for hundreds of years to help keep them prepared for everyday survival for hunting and fishing.
Kenai athlete Corey Olympic has to wait a few days for his best event, the Indian stick pull. The ninth grader says his small size puts him at a disadvantage in some of the games. But if there was a competition for best hair, he would be a shoo-in. He describes his style this way.
It's like when you're on a boat and it's windy out and the wind's going through your hair.
It's actually a bleached-out mohawk molded into impossibly long, pointy spikes that defy gravity. He plans to keep growing it out for 3 more years to win a bet with his auntie.
Well, she thinks that I won't last till I graduate high school. But if I do cut it, I owe 200. But if I don't cut it and wait till I graduate, she owes me 200.
Corey seems determined, and says luckily his hair doesn't get in the way too much when he's competing at NYO. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. North Rim Bank, reminding you that you have a second chance to help other Alaskans. If you filed for your PFD online, you can safely donate a portion of your dividend to your favorite Alaska cause. Log into the PFD website and pick, click, give. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu. And by Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at penair.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.